Welcome to the College Football Survivor Show, where playoff survival is always on the line. Here's Shahan J. Haraja and Babak Hayeri.
Hey everybody, it's the College Football Survivor Show. I'm Babak Hayeri with my co-host Shahan J. Haraja, national college football writer for CBS Sports. Today we'll be taking a gander at some of the topics going on right now in college sports. Did Arkansas just show us that the SEC Big Ten will prioritize non-football? Taking a look at what we learned from Auburn's spring game, as well as a bit on Clemson's. And, you know, what else are we looking forward to this weekend in the spring game world? Finally, we've got a new commissioner in the American. Shahan and I will talk a little bit about Tim Pernetti. But before we dive in, let me remind you that you can find us on X and TikTok at CFB Survivor Show, where we have video highlights of the show, run polls, and listen to your feedback. Take a moment, if you can, to like, rate, and subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. You know, we pushed back our Monday recording session for this episode just a little bit to make room for the solar eclipse. You know, Shahan, once upon a time, there was a light in my life, but now there's only love in the dark. Nothing I can say, a total eclipse of the heart.
Is that like a reference from the 1900s? Is that a... No, I'm just kidding.
You're killing me, man. I love it.
We were right in the view of it. We're in Dallas, which is technically the biggest city in the total eclipse pathway. And I'll tell you what, it was actually as cool as people said it was going to be. It was crazy. I did not expect that very much. But it like you just sit outside and all of a sudden, like you got the glasses on and you're paying attention to the sun. And then, like, all of a sudden, you can just, like, take the glasses off and you can just, like, see in the sky. There's just this black dot with a ring around it. It's insane. We got very lucky. It's been cloudy all weekend. And the heavens basically opened up just in time for the eclipse, which was pretty cool. So it was incredible. Like it was a lot better than I expected it to be. I guess I understand now why everybody was talking about it so much.
I'm glad to hear that. I've never actually been in the full eclipse. And I'm here in Minnesota. We got grazed, but it's been a deeply overcast day. So, and I've been in a partial eclipse before and you don't really notice it that much. And when you already have an extremely dark sky to begin with, yeah, there was nothing out here. I mean, if it got darker out, I would be terrified of like a tornado or something. It didn't even get that darkness of sky. So y'all got lucky out there. I'm envious. It must be really neat to see it. Or, you know, or is it just a myth, or do eclipses actually exist? I don't know. But no, I'm not going to go
down
that.
Well, one thing that my wife was saying is like, huh, no wonder that when this stuff happened in like ancient times or with old stories, people freaked out, right? Like it was like this crazy sort of like, oh my God, we're cursed by the gods, because like it's creepy, man. Like it is, you just all of a sudden you're sitting there, it's a totally normal day, and then it's as dark as night, like in the course of minutes, and then it's back just like 4 minutes later. So I totally understand why people in ancient days probably felt like they were being cursed by the gods anytime an eclipse happened, because it kind of does feel like that.
Yeah, it was like a minor point of plot in that Mel Gibson movie, Apocalypto, set in Mesoamerican times. Like something, because it was playing off the fact that they were kind of more sophisticated, at least at the elite level, and they were using it to manipulate people. It was a minor plot point. I'm not giving away the movie at all, but I thought that was kind of a fun reference that I saw made, because it kind of dived into that kind of statement of like, what if you could, I mean, if you were in ancient times, what if you were the smart one, or at least the one that wanted to take advantage, like, you have all angered me, he's the king, you know, or or something like that. I don't know, but we should dive in a little bit into the sports, only because there was some interesting stuff that happened this weekend. You know, I'm going to first just say, because we talked a little bit about the basketball tournament heading into this past weekend, last week during an episode. And I just want to emphasize, you know, there is one of the players who, obviously their season's done, but they really should try out for the NFL. And I'm speaking, of course, of Caitlin Clark. I think she should absolutely put her best foot forward there and take her talent somewhere where she can get a payday commensurate with her talent level. I think it's exciting to see how she's going to be. But, you know.
I don't know what you're talking about. If you want to make real money, you play basketball. That's the sport where you make real money, where you make some millions. If you're in the NFL, and obviously this is a reference to the conversation about DJ Burns as well, the NC State big man. But, like, everybody's like, well, why doesn't he just try to be a practice squad left tackle? Like, do you know how much more money and how much more job security you can get just being a two-way contract guy in the NBA? Like, that alone gets you to 700K. That doesn't even count him going overseas and having a chance to maybe make up to seven figures as a European player. And I'll tell you what, his game would translate well to the EuroLeague because of how they play. They're a big physical league that loves post play. And also, by the way, Caitlin Clark is going to make probably more money as a WNBA star with the endorsement deals that she's got and all this sort of stuff than most players will ever make in the NFL. And also, by the way, then the players will make in college basketball, too. So let's just get that out of the way as well, that that she's taking a pay cut to move up and be a professional. But yeah, it's anyway. This obviously.
Yeah, well, DJ, yeah, at the very least, yeah. You know, Jonte Porter proved you can make a side hustle on your playing career if you really need to. No. Don't gamble on yourself. That's a bad idea.
Don't. I know people are always saying bet on yourself. Don't do that.
Don't literally gamble. Yeah, don't literally bet on yourself, at least in a situation that could get you federal charges. Oh, my goodness. But going back, kind of sticking with basketball, one of the big moves this week was, you know, Arkansas surprised everybody by hiring away John Calipari from Kentucky. You know, the one thing I immediately said, and this is probably because I'm a USC alumnus, is like, wait, USC could have got him instead of Musselman? I'm sure, don't get me wrong, it's way too early to see how things are going to turn out. But what are your thoughts on this? I mean, on both the basketball level, but also, and I think it makes an interesting point, as you brought up, where this would fit into the SEC, Big Ten, you know, turning into football Goliaths. Does that mean they're going to now have more more bread to spread on their non-football programs?
Well, I'll tell you what, I will say, I don't think that USC could have just chosen between John Calipari and Eric Musselman. It took some maneuvering, I think, for this to work out the way that it did. The funny thing about all of this is, you know, SMU, they go and they fire their head coach, Rob Lanier, who, by the way, is immediately picked up by Rice. Like, they are excited to get him right away because he was a good mid-major coach. But they go, they make a big swing for a coach in Andy Enfield that I think that USC fans were kind of like, all right, we've been.
It was the Calipari of USC.
Yeah,
at that point.
It is what it is. We're kind of maybe done with this. I don't know if I don't think that there's this crazy upside that we're not hitting as yet, especially, by the way, when they had Bronny James and Isaiah Collier come in and didn't do anything with it. So, like, it's kind of like not a firing by any means, but it's like a, do you want to go to SMU? That's all right. But then SMU gets to be like, we stole USC's basketball coach. And then I think it was kind of that too with Eric Musselman in Arkansas, where it was like, you kind of pissed off some of the wrong people, but you're really successful. So USC can be like, we got this multiple time Elite Eight coach, this guy who's brought in these five-star type players. And then after that, you have like, oh, you know, John Calipari, maybe, like, we were talking about, is Kentucky going to pay $34 million to buy out his contract just a minute ago? So now he's like, well, I don't feel wanted anymore. I'm going to go. So again, not a firing, but like kind of like a, all right, let's, you know, cool, I guess, that sort of thing. So, you know, look, could John Calipari, would he have made the jump all the way to USC? I don't necessarily think so. Arkansas is pretty serious about wanting to compete in basketball, and I have not a lot of faith that USC is that right now. There was rumor that John Calipari was tied a bit with Ohio State, but the timing didn't quite work out. Okay, sure. I mean, one thing that I'll say is that I know that Arkansas people, especially some people kind of high up, boosters, things like that, they were kind of done with Eric Musselman, the personality of it. I mean, he's the first coach to make Elite Eights at Arkansas since Nolan Richardson left. So I hope that they don't have a little bit of buyer's remorse, because John Calipari, I will mention too, he hasn't been to the second weekend of the tournament since 2019. He hasn't been to the Final Four since 2015. He has one title. It was in 2012. So this, I think, brings me to like the big question about John Calipari, which is this Arkansas with a coup, or is this basketball's Jimbo Fisher, where Jimbo Fisher was a successful coach who was hired away when things didn't seem to be going all that great, when he seemed to be falling behind the rest of the sport, when he seemed to be out of date. They gave him a ton of money. They gave him unlimited resources, by the way, NIL money, which is something that Arkansas has definitely brought up. But again, this is a coach who is one of the all-time great coaches. There's no doubt about it, who also hasn't been one of the all-time great coaches in like 7 years at this point. So which do you think it more is? Is this a coup by Arkansas, or is this a Jimbo Fisher?
You know, I can make another analogy because my other alma mater is Minnesota. And I was already a graduate when Tubby Smith was lured away to be the head coach, and everyone at Minnesota was like, oh my gosh, how did we get Tubby Smith? And then it turns out Tubby Smith was just kind of looking for another couple of paychecks and wasn't really that into the, you know, I'm sure he was into winning, but Minnesota did not get the Tubby Smith of old. So I do wonder, I think that might even be a more basketball-y version of the Jimbo, because I mean, maybe that was it. Maybe that Jimbo was like Tubby Smith. But it's always impossible to tell, isn't it? I mean, you could make that kind of a comparison with like when Urban Meyer was suddenly brought out again for Ohio State. You know, are we past, you know, the expiration date on him?
I mean, he went out much more on top, I'd say, than certainly John Calipari.
Oh, no. Oh, yeah. And you're right. I mean, no. And actually, that's a good question. How many coaches have been kind of looked like they might have been slowing down, and then once they get into a new position, they re-energize? That's hard to do. I mean, you can't really, I mean, because I don't feel comfortable with Nick Saban, because obviously going to the NFL, it just wasn't
not the same.
Fit. Yeah, not the same at all. Man, I don't know. Because I mean, who else would be like that? Les Miles? Like, he would be another comparison of a guy who everyone was like, oh, yeah, he'll be great. And then you're like, holy crap, did that not work?
Well, that of course, at Kansas was a lot of off-field stuff. But I don't think it's going to go as bad as Jimbo Fisher, to be clear. But I do think that in John Calipari, you know, a lot of the criticisms that you hear of Jimbo are true of John Calipari, where he's a recruiter first, and also second, and also third, fourth, and fifth, and maybe didn't do a good enough job of actually evolving, not just coaching on the field and X and O's, which is something that I think you've seen of Cal, but also just adjusting to the times, adjusting to the way that you manage a program, adjusting to the way of fitting into an athletic department. I mean, One of the real football connections with this is that John Calipari got into power struggles with Mark Stoops, the football coach at Kentucky, and with Mitch Barnhart, the athletic director, and essentially was like, you need to essentially kiss the ring every single time that I ask. And you can't both demand that people kiss the ring and then lose to St. Peter's in Oakland. That just can't happen. So I do think that Arkansas, I think things are going to work for a while there, right? Like I could see the path being quite Jimbo, right? Where maybe those first 2 to 3 years you see a build, and maybe they have a great season in year three or something like that. And then it just gets complacent, and then it just falls behind. And I mean, this is one of the fascinating questions too, that Kentucky in some ways has answered. Is, you know, Kentucky has been, over the past 15 years, the program when it comes to developing NBA talent. And they had like a five-year stretch. I think they made the Final Four like five straight years, which is insane at the beginning of his tenure. But how much do you value being a producer of talent versus how much do you value winning basketball games and winning SEC titles and making Final Fours and winning national championships? And I think that certainly at Kentucky, I mean, you're there to win championships. That's your job. I think that like at Arkansas, there's going to be some novelty when You have a few of these players come through, and they had some players under Eric Musselman too, right? Like Anthony Black was the number six pick in the draft. Nick Smith was the number one overall recruit who went to Arkansas and fell because of his injury issues. But I mean, this is probably going to be a different level of NBA talent come through your program consistently. But how exciting is that? At what point do you need to see results of that? And to get to sort of the other question with John Calipari and with Arkansas, is this, being Arkansas, going to be a program that becomes not a Kentucky level, but in this new SEC era, becomes a basketball first program? That becomes a program that certainly wants to compete on the football field. I mean, in Arkansas is a football state. Arkansas is a proud football program. But in an SEC out of 16 SEC teams, where does Arkansas rank in terms of resources? Probably like 11th, right? Like they are nowhere close to the top. They're barely in the middle, I think you could argue, with the way that things are right now. Do they put this extra resource, money, attention, fan support, do they put it into basketball now? Because like Sam Pittman's trying to win, you know, 8 games, and like that's the ceiling. That's kind of what you can accomplish at Arkansas right now.
Boy, I don't know. That I mean, how could it change? It would take, well, oddly enough, someone like a John Calipari going there and succeeding and getting people so excited about, you know, becoming a national title contender perennially. It would take a period of time like that, almost a Saban-like era of basketball. But I mean, I've been to Arkansas for a football game. I know what it's like to be in that stadium and how intense they are, even in a lousy season. So that it's going to be hard to convince them that you're no longer Arkansas, right? You're Kentucky now. You know, it's going to be a hard one. Cause I mean, they've got, you know, tremendous alumni in that football program. Obviously, the owner of the Cowboys down where you're at is one of their alumni. They're serious about football. That would be a tough one. You know, actually, you maybe kind of start to think, because two things. One, Kentucky should have Stoops help hire the next basketball coach, because that would be hilarious. Two, I wonder if we end up with Petrino as the head coach of Arkansas, what that kind of clash of egos would be like in in Fayetteville. My goodness, I'm looking forward to seeing how that turns out. I mean, another thing, too, that you brought up, because I'm sure Musselman's taken some players that are going to go with him to USC. Some players are done. So Calipari is going to get a chance to build a team. And the question is he going to still go with the way that wasn't entirely working, or at least was causing the tension at Kentucky? Or is he going to use this as a refresh for himself? Is he willing to learn? Is he willing to try something new? Again, that's part of what makes someone like Saban so impressive, is that he was willing to kind of like, go like, all right, this isn't quite like recruiting will always work, but the rest of it, like strategy and things, is like, okay, let me make some alterations to it. So I'm curious to see what moves he makes and how quickly he moves them. Or is he going to end up like, you know, someone like Lincoln Riley, where suddenly they end up at USC and now we're hoping. Like, if you're a USC fan, you're hoping he's kind of learned, and certainly the offseason looks a little more positive if you're a Trojans fan. But what kind of moves are we going to see from him when it gets, or is it going to be Tubby Smith 2.0? I'm curious to see it.
No, it's a great question, and I think this is going to be something that you know, it goes back in some ways to a quote that Bo Nix, former Auburn quarterback, former now Oregon quarterback, NFL draft prospect, said the other day, which is he basically said, you know what, like people in the South care too much about football in some ways. Like that's what he said. Like he said that this attention actually ends up being over the top. And when you're out at Oregon, you can actually be a better player in some ways. Because you're given something that's a bit more manageable, because you're able to both be a great football player, a better football team, by the way, than the one that he left, and still have a chance to grow and turn into a first round potential draft prospect and win a lot of games and all this sort of stuff. And that's what I'm most curious about, especially in the SEC. I mean, certainly the Big Ten will have some of these dynamics too, with now 18 teams and a lot of teams that expect to be good at stuff. But I think the SEC kind of stands apart because of that rabid attention paid to SEC athletics. Like, how do you manage this if you are one of these athletic departments that maybe can't hang? Like, what do you do? I think of Mississippi State, right? Mississippi State, a great, proud athletic department that expects, they don't expect to be competing for the conference, but they expect to be finishing with winning records. They expect to be competing for bowl games. They expect to be competing with their rival, Ole Miss. And like, what if they're just a 3-9 team forever now? Like, what if that's what they are? Because they are 14th in resource out of 16 SEC football teams. Like, what do you do with that fan passion? How do you manage this? And so, you know, I do think that Mississippi State is a good example. Like, they've leveraged that into baseball attention and investment. They've leveraged that at times into women's basketball, right? They were in the national championship game not that long ago. Is this something that SC fans and fan base have to deal with? Or is there just going to be half of a football league that cares a lot that just is filled with existential dread because they know that they just can't hang?
You know, I know offline we were talking about this earlier today when you were talking about how Minnesota just doesn't seem to ever wake up or even keep the star players like Larry Fitzgerald or the women's basketball talent that's come out of here. But it also made me think of how, as we see, because obviously now the SEC and Big Ten are similar in the sense that they're going to be, you know, leviathans of money with the ability to spend it, but not always necessarily compete evenly at a sport like football. And I think historically, that's why Minnesota has always kind of also had a strong hockey team. So, like, you know, it's a different set of rivalries. I mean, obviously, North Dakota, historically, they were in the same conference. And then the Big Ten decided to actually sponsor hockey. But Michigan as well, there's like a handful of teams that take it really seriously. And there is support for them. I mean, again, you go out to the Northeast to get the bean pot between all the Boston schools. But I'm curious to see that. Like, will we see some teams emphasize that? And I get where, I don't know if Arkansas will necessarily be a team that's going to go, all right, football's been neat and everything. That's more Vandy's baseball team. You know what I mean? You know, let's put that Whistler on scholarship. I don't know, like whatever they do down there. But I'm curious to see where that goes. I'll tell you a school that's seeing this as a lot of pain is Oregon State, because that was like their thing. Like, oh, we're also really good at baseball, because the sports up there are a little weird. Like, Oregon State got a baseball team, but historically Oregon didn't. But you know, now they're kind of left out of the dance. So ultimately, we do know football is one of the major reasons, if not the major reason, for a lot of these moves. But I'd be curious to see it. Some schools, the ones that are very good at sponsoring more than one sport at once, like a Texas, like a UCLA, football, sleeping giant purportedly, you know, where they could go with it. But yeah, it's a great question. I wonder what other programs might decide to take that way. Because again, Vanderbilt was an obvious one. I thought Mississippi State was a great call. Minnesota, I'm being charitable when I mention hockey.
Well, because it is South Carolina women's basketball, I think, is a good example of one. You know, they're also a program that's struggling. I will go back for a second to the Minnesota conversation. I've been texting you all day about this because, like, it's not just the fact that they have some good players. They are like an elite producer of basketball talent right now. It's not just on the women's side. Of course, Paige Becker is the headliner of that, but also Tessa Johnson, the South Carolina player who led them in scoring in the title game, is from Minnesota. On the men's side, you've got the Jones brothers, Tyus and Trey Jones, who both played at Duke. You've got Matthew Hurt played at Duke, Chet Holmgren, Jalen Suggs. And, like, they're not even competitive for them. I do not understand how this athletic department is so comfortable being so invisible with the level of players that are coming out of their own city in many cases. I'm not
That's
saying
that.
That's
a very Minnesota attitude.
Yeah,
that's
it is.
That's a very Minnesota attitude. You don't want to boast. No.
I don't want to boast. I'm not.
You just want to be your own little quiet lane, you know.
I'm certainly not saying that, like, anybody, like, there's no reason that Paige Beckers or Chet Holmes, I'm not saying that you should have landed them. That's certainly not the bar. But how do you miss on every single one of them? How do you never get a single, like, good player to have come from the state of Minnesota? It is infuriating to me, to be honest. And so, you know, it's going to be an interesting dynamic long term, how they end up managing that, because I think that this is an athletic department that is in a major city that should continue to be growing, and it doesn't feel like it is.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be interesting to see how some of these programs figure out what they're going to do, as there are a bounty of teams in these two mega conferences that can compete financially with each other. You know, next we'll take a quick break and come back to talk about some of the spring game action on the College Football Survivor Show.
The College Football Survivor Show, where playoff survival is always on the line.
So this past weekend, there were a couple of interesting spring games. The two that we really wanted to kind of talk about were Auburn and Clemson. Kind of starting out with this whole, because last year, Auburn's offense was a bit of a disappointment for a variety of reasons that we've talked about before. And it seems like an unsurprising star emerged from their spring game. Sean, what do we make of Cam Coleman? Can he fix them?
Well, it's interesting, right? Because I don't think that their wide receiver room was horrendous last year, but they sure performed horrendous. I blame the quarterback situation a lot for that. But sometimes when you've got a dude like they've got, it can help fill some holes. You know, they didn't have a single wide receiver with more than 350 yards receiving across the entirety of last year. They had two total passing plays over 50 yards, one of which was to a wide open tight end. And in the first quarter of his first spring game, Cam Coleman goes for a 50-yard reception. It was a great play. It was only the first of his big plays. He also had a touchdown catch later in the game that they posted to social media. And I'll tell you what, he looks like the kind of receiver that they have not had in that program for a while. I mean, I said after the 50-yard pass, this felt like maybe the best passing play that Auburn has had since Bo Nix left. That's a course of 3 years at this point, right? Like, I mean, even probably, you know, it's back to the Gus Malzahn era that you're talking about having a passing play like that. I do want to say also, it's not just Cam Coleman, who obviously had an incredible game and I think can change a whole lot for them. It's also the guy who was throwing it to him. Hank Brown, the redshirt freshman, looked really good in that game. Peyton Thorne is the incumbent starter, but I love the fact that they're having somebody come in and push him. You know, Hank Brown wasn't the main guy who played backup even last season. Holden Gariner did, but Hank Brown's come in. I think he looked good. I think that Walker White, I'm still pretty excited about. I don't know if he's ready. But I'll tell you what, if Hank Brown goes and jumps both of these players who are older than him and manages to win the starting job, that helps, man. That helps a whole lot to potentially have a passing game with more dynamic components than we've seen off from the start. But, you know, Cam Coleman was the number 5 overall player in the top 247 rankings. He was the number 2 receiver, only behind Jeremiah Smith at Ohio State, which, by the way, after Cam Coleman's big day, Ohio State very notably put out a highlight of Jeremiah Smith making a crazy catch, just to be like, let's slow your horses, man. Like, let's remember who number 1 was. But I think that Cam Coleman is potentially a game changer for him. And you have to also factor in too, you know, Caleb Burton was a transfer last year from Ohio State who factored into the rotation. He didn't play in the spring game, but I think we'll have a chance to have a bigger role. They added a transfer in Sam Jackson V, who played quarterback at Cal and at TCU. Some people might remember. Well, now he's going to be a wide receiver at Auburn. And they also have more players coming in, most notably Perry Thompson, a top 40 recruit at wide receiver as well. So, look, can you fix an entire offense with just wide receivers? I think it takes a little more than that. You got to grow up that quarterback position. You got to continue to get better on the offensive line. But this is exactly what you wanted to see from Auburn's offense, especially knowing that Hugh Freeze is taking over play calling. You wanted to see it look just a little bit different, not just in terms of results, but in terms of approach. And with Cam Coleman in the lineup, I think they did that.
Yeah, and, you know, Cam had a couple of really interesting plays. Like, one of the plays he didn't catch actually got a lot of attention. It was a classic reaching around behind the behind the defender to kind of catch a ball. Didn't quite get it, but, again, that caught a lot of attention. It was interesting, too, because Hugh Freeze said some of the – because it was a closer game than I think they would have liked to have seen. But he said some of it seemed to be that they were putting a little too much on Cam Coleman. They were expecting – he wasn't quite as familiar with the playbook. So in the red zone, he was not quite in place yet, which is fine. Like, again, he literally just got there. He went to prom after the spring game, from what I understand. So, I mean, like, he enrolled early, but he's still kind of finishing out his whole high school career, which is – I can't even imagine that level of adding the NIL to all of it. I can't even imagine that level of like responsibility and balance when I was his age. But I think that's exciting. And they also, one other wide receiver that looked good was Robert Lewis, the Georgia State transfer. I mean, again, with Cam Coleman, all the attention was on him, but Lewis also was able to make some good catches and look like another part of that offense. And you know, Peyton Thorne, there were some words. I know some of the analysis from some of the folks that really follow Auburn thought, again, he looked better this particular spring game. And how much of that is a receiver? Because even he said, Thorne, that a good receiver, because he has seen some great receivers that have left Auburn, obviously. So he's like, some of the guys that we've had, you know, when you have a good receiver, a 50-50 ball becomes an 80-20 ball. So maybe that's also it, you know, suddenly the quarterbacks are going to look better because the people they're throwing to can make those plays. It's going to be an exciting time. I mean, if you're an Auburn fan, certainly it gives you a little bit of excitement. That's what you look for in that spring game, that to get fans galvanized until things either work out or you hit a midseason steamroller. We'll see, but better things looking up and up, I think, on the Plains for the Tigers. That's for sure. So, moving over to Death Valley and another set of Tigers, what do we make of Clemson's spring game?
Yeah, I definitely was less encouraged by Clemson's performance than Auburn's. Nothing. I mean, look, it's a spring game. You don't want to overreact to things, but I'm always a little concerned when the headlines coming out of camp are, wow, the defense looks great.
Great.
Nice job, defense. They completely shut down the offense. That's not completely what happened, but Cade Klubnik didn't necessarily take some of the steps that he hoped, only completed half his passes. Again, like we talked about when we were previewing the spring games, this is a situation where you want to evaluate what individual players are doing. And so, you know, it wasn't just the fact, like stats are only one part of it. It's the fact that there were still miscommunications with the receivers, that they weren't on the same page. We've talked at length about the fact that Clemson has been reluctant to use the transfer portal to try to fill some of their holes. And so, you know, at receiver, it looked like it. They did have a nice player in Bryant Wesco coming in as a freshman at wide receiver who managed to factor into the rotation. But are they going to be able to improve enough with just internal growth at receiver? I don't necessarily know. Receiver has been one of my biggest issues with Clemson's program over the past couple of years. I think, you know, so much attention has been paid to the quarterback position or the offensive coordinator, but they haven't had the kind of receivers that they had when Deshaun Watson and Trevor Lawrence were there. There isn't a Mike Williams. There isn't even a Hunter Renfrow or any of these sort of guys. And so, to me, I don't think that they've answered that question whatsoever. The offensive line also, under first-year offensive line coach Matt Luke, it's going to take some time. And Matt Luke is one of the better offensive line coaches in the country. But I don't think that I saw the developments I hoped to see in year two of the Garrett Riley era on the offense. Now, defensively, I do think that they did some things well, right? Like, this is a tough defense to play against in a spring game, man. Like Clemson is a defensive program. They've continued to recruit the defensive line well. I really liked what they had at linebacker. I think that they looked like they're ready for prime time. But what I wanted and needed to see was some positive signs from the offense, and don't feel like I saw that.
Yeah, I think Dabo, after the game, when asked about the offense, said, it was incomplete, but I think a more accurate reading was it was returned for 46 yards and picked off two more times. Because again, it was not a good day for the, I mean, at least overall for the starting quarterbacks. Although I've heard they at least they have a question on the backup quarterback. Like Trent Perriman was apparently impressive in his play when he got an opportunity. But that's not what you want to hear about your offense. It's like, you know, the third quarterback's actually looking pretty good. Maybe it should be the second quarterback. And, you know, you hope for more. But, of course, hey, you know, I will say that the defense is at least something to take away. And that is what makes spring games awkward. Like, what if this defense ends up being like, in, you know, 6 months from now, or I guess a little more than that, we're just talking about like this is one of the greatest defenses of all time. You never know. You never know. They certainly
maybe,
have depth.
Maybe.
But yeah, no. It's going to be curious to see when the spring portal window opens if Clemson suddenly gets a little more aggressive, any more aggressive than it has been in the past to kind of pursue some new players in there. You know, heading into this weekend, though, we've got a couple of really big spring games coming up. We've got Alabama. Everyone's going to be curious about that one. Kalen DeBoer. I mean, who doesn't want to see what's happening there? And the talent at Ohio State finally coming on display for everyone to see. I'm not crazy to say those are the two marquee spring games that are coming up. Am I? I mean, we might even talk about them a little bit in a later episode. But I just want to say, looking forward, are those the two that have got your attention the most?
Yeah, they have to. I mean, you talk about Ohio State. This is a program that has national championship expectations, that has an open quarterback battle, that has so many new contributors that they brought into the program. Like, this is it, man. This is the moment. And actually, Ohio State spring game is actually going to be aired on Fox, like on Big Fox. Yeah. They're going to put it on. That's crazy. On network television, they're going to put a spring game on. So to say that there are expectations, I think that is very fair to say. Actually, I'll have a piece going up later this week at CBS Sports talking just a little bit about the expectations that Ohio State and Georgia have, not just heading into these spring games, but heading into this upcoming season as well. I mean, these are the favorites, right? Like, these are the two favorites. These are the two teams that everybody expects to be in that Final Four, to have a chance to be in that title game, to win a national championship. They have to show some stuff. It's not going to be as easy as I think it was in prior years. I think that they're going to have to step up.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, moving on to one just last topic we wanted to get in here. The American, formerly known as the Big East, and I only say that because they need a new commissioner. Oresco is the one who guided their change to being the Big East that some of us still remember from football era to being the American Conference, which has changed in many ways year after year, including this very last season. So they go out and they get Tim Pernetti. Now, I know you wrote a little bit of a piece on that also for CBS Sports. I kind of jokingly said they hired a high school administrator to be the new commissioner, which obviously is a but what should we know? What are your thoughts on hiring Pernetti to be over there? Because I do remember the way he left Rutgers, but that was kind of it was an interesting situation that fell into a lot of larger currents affecting the nation that I think he kind of, I mean, I'm not even, we can get into that more, but what are your thoughts just over this?
It sounds like a cancel culture run amok back in 2013 or whatever. Anyway, so it's an interesting hire because this is somebody who has experience on both the business side and the administration side of college athletics. You mentioned he had a tenure as Rutgers athletic director. He was the athletic director who helped negotiate their entrance to the Big Ten. So Rutgers fans, congratulations to you on Tim Pernetti being your athletic director, because that sure paid off.
Yeah.
But I think the other piece that you have to look at is he has a background of sorts in sports media. He actually did some on-air work back in the day. And then after that, he worked for IMG Learfield and eventually IMG. And then, like you said, ultimately became the CEO of IMG Academy, ran the program over there where they go and certainly develop some of the best athletes in the world, have these crazy sort of, recruiting grounds where they go and kind of develop players for that next level. The other piece too, though, to mention even about his time at IMG in IMG Academy is that he was one of the people who helped negotiate the women's basketball bubble back when they hosted that during the COVID pandemic, right? So like when the WNBA did it. So he has been somebody who has experience doing a little bit of everything. And I think that that's what makes this an interesting move. He's run athletic department budgets, but he's also dealt with sports marketing contracts. He's also dealt with television networks. He has an understanding, I think, of where sports business is going in a lot of ways. And, you know, just to compare him for a second to the outgoing commissioner, Mike Oresko, like Mike Oresko was a full-time television executive. He actually worked for a long time at CBS, obviously my employers. We don't get to get very much in the weeds of what the television network is doing as reporters ever here, but obviously a significant thing. He was kind of the guy who helped bring SEC on CBS to the forefront and made it a national brand. And so you're going from a full-time type of sports executive to somebody who's maybe a bit more balanced. The piece to pay attention to about this, and he will be officially introduced on Thursday. I'm hoping to make it out there. It's out in Dallas. Mm-hmm. Is he's going to be one of the members of the CFP Management Committee. It's all 10 conference commissioners and Notre Dame's athletic director make up that committee. And so he's going to have one of those votes. Now, we'll kind of have to wait and see whether you know, whether the Pac-2 continues to get a vote or what ends up happening with that over there. But he's going to be one of the votes on this committee. And so I do think that he's going to come at things in a similar way, right? Like maintaining that, I mean, I'm not even saying the Power Six branding, but maintaining that level of authority, maintaining that level of, you know, trying to basically be a player in the national game. I know was a priority for these AAC schools. There's a reason that six of them left the Conference USA in order to come to this league, because they want to feel like they are the best non-power conference. And so I do think that he's going to try from the start to make his case that, you know, one, we have to make sure and preserve long-term spots for the group of five in the college football playoff. I think that's going to be for every group of five commissioner a top priority, but also continuing to increase access, continuing to expand this ESPN contract that the American Athletic Conference has. And ultimately, I think it's also going to be fascinating to see, you know, what is sort of his first move as AAC commissioner? What's the priority that he brings to the table whenever he is introduced on Thursday? Again, with somebody with such a wealth of different experiences, it could be almost anything.
I hope it's announcing the new motto for the conference, which is the Power Six. Pardon me, the Power Five. He's got to go to the Power Five.
The Power Five.
And
power
just five. And say that in or say that at the first CFP conference while the Pac-12 representative is at the table. Just kind of like, look, it would almost be like The Office, where you'd see him say that and the camera would just turn to a really kind of dejected Pac-12 commissioner. Oh my goodness. Like, no, it's exciting to see, although I wonder who start. I mean, because I remember the birth of the American, because the Big East nearly imploded. It was just kind of a mess. They lost the name because of the argument with the basketball teams that stayed behind and kind of reformulated themselves as a strong basketball conference. Who's starting with a stronger hand? I mean, because Oresko was in kind of a tight spot there. And perhaps maybe he was able to, he clearly built it up to the point where so many of his teams were attractive to the other power conferences, we'll say charitably the other ones. But now we've got a program. We have a conference that's been somewhat gutted. You know, they've lost a lot of key teams, obviously to the Big 12 in particular, and one who is willing to take any deal to go to the ACC. Is this going to be a tough call? Is this going to be a tough hand for him? I'm not sure what. I do wonder what the upside's going to be. I mean, what would be success for him? Would it be being the best of the non P4 conferences, or would it? And can he do that? Because I mean, now there's, I mean, the Conference USA. Okay, I'm going to give them they've kind of fallen to the bottom of the pile. Maybe they can climb their way up. I mean, I remember when the Sun Belt was the basket case, and they've clearly improved their lot in life. But I'm wondering where the American can go, and can this goes back to the classic question: can a team reach the heights that we saw previously with a Houston or UCF, or is that day gone?
Well, it's funny. I think first the priority is going to be just maintaining where they've been. I mean, the AAC has been the best group of five conference over the past decade since they were formed in 2012. And they've had the majority of the New Year's Six spots in the BCS system first, and then moving on to, of course, the New Year's Six system. They've also maintained having more of those spots taken up than anybody. So that'll be their first priority, is trying to develop programs and develop a conference that can consistently fill that role. So many of the teams that have been able to compete at that higher level are now gone, like you mentioned, with Houston being a New Year's Six champion, with Cincinnati being a New Year's Six champion. You know, I think that even, you know, Tulane is probably the team now that you're relying on in some ways. UTSA, I'll be curious to see if North Texas can continue to take a step. UAB is a program that should be competing better than it is, though they might have to make a football coaching change before they're able to do that more consistently. But you still have, I think, the best collection of teams out of the group of five. The question now is going to be, you know, I think that what Tim Pernetti should be looking for as he tries to plan the next 5 to 10 years is you want to have multiple teams every single year competing to be in the top 25. They don't have to stay there. Like, I'm not saying that you need four teams to be ranked in the final top 25 every single year, but I think that if you have teams that are cycling through the end of that rankings, that's a good place to be. I looked to last year, and of course, Liberty was able to bulldoze through their schedule because they played a very easy schedule, didn't play anybody in the non-conference. But, you know, you had Tulane and SMU. And I mean, that's a good place to be. If you can continue to have that level of program, UTSA has been that program in the past. Memphis is really the team that should, I think, step up as their flagship program of the AAC. I think that that's what you're looking for, is you want to have multiple different contenders. Because if you're dependent on one team, like I look at the Mountain West, I think that, you know, maybe this isn't fair, but I think that Boise State is the one team that can consistently be a, you know, a high level team. Maybe you can factor San Diego State in there in some ways, but I think that Boise State is kind of in a class of its own over there. I don't think it's a good thing for your league, because it means that if Boise State's not having a great year, then like your league isn't competing for the college football playoff. What you want is that when Memphis is having a down year, that UTSA or Tulane or any one of these other programs has a chance to step up into their place, that there will be a team every single year that, even if they don't get the college football playoff spot, is very competitive for the college football playoff spot. And I think the other piece is you are unlikely to win very many of these college football playoff games. I mean, it's a tough position to be in as a group of five league, because you're going to be going against the number five team in the college football playoff rankings, which like could be the loser of the SEC title game. You could be going against Georgia because they lost to Alabama or Texas, right? Like, that's not going to be ideal for anybody. It's not going to be ideal for the Big 12 or ACC champion. It's not going to be ideal for the Big 10 champion potentially to go against the loser of the SEC title game. But I do think that you want to be competitive as well. The worst thing that could happen if you're the AAC right now is to consistently make the playoff and have Liberty Fiesta Bowl-like performances. You do not want to look like you are lesser than. You don't have to win these games, but you have to look like you belong in a lot of ways. And having multiple teams that can build up to that level, which I certainly believe that the AAC still does, I think that that is a marker of success for Tim Pernetti. And I think that that is what they need to be focusing on long term, is just getting multiple programs that are able to get up to the level of just competing, even if it's not winning.
I think that's a great point. Yeah, because I also remember earlier Mountain West era, where it was not just Boise State, but Utah and TCU were excellent. But of course, then they got poached away, which is kind of what happened to the American just now. But at the same time, I mean, I think it is a little early to write off the success of potential for some of those programs. I mean, one of these days, and I'm not doing the sleeping giant, but when you mentioned Memphis, I thought of ECU. I mean, East Carolina keeps
One of these days, man. One of these days.
Pour money into that program. They just doesn't quite seem to work out. I don't know if the pirates keep like looting it and hiding it, and you know they bury it in a random island.
It's the curse after they. Oh my gosh, what's the coach that they fired? Ruffin McNeil. The curse of Ruffin McNeil. They're never going to win again because Ruffin McNeil has now cursed them.
But of course, again, you've got Tulane, you've got UTSA, and I do think FAU has proven that they seem to have something. It seems like, they could get it going. And also, South Florida has slowly been building things up. I mean, I have been genuinely impressed over the last several years of how they're approaching that stadium project. Because no one pays attention to it because they're doing it so, like, the right way. Like, oh, we're going to have a meeting and talk about whether a stadium would work on campus. Oh, they agreed it would. Now we're going to talk about where we might put it on campus. Oh, look, there it is. Now let's put a budget out. Oh, look, the budget was like, people don't pay attention to them because it's going the way it's supposed to go. But they're going to have a stadium in a couple of years on campus, which will be huge for USF, which would theoretically, if it worked, I mean, they're a huge state university like UCF. I mean, it could pay off there as well, quietly. In the background, they will no longer have a pirate ship in their stadium, or in the case of Houston, have a stadium named after one of the other teams in the American, also named after pirates. But
so one thing that I think has to be a great indicator for the AAC as Tim Pernetti takes over is the fact that Tulane was able to go and get John Sumrall. Mm. Like the fact that the best coach in the Sun Belt just decided to leave because he thought that he could achieve more in the AAC at a program that is more advantaged, but not crazy more advantaged by any means. And so, look, you almost have to view college football heading forward as in like the separation, right? Like you can't be comparing top group of five jobs to top, certainly, power five jobs or power four now jobs. But I think that what you can compare is there is stratification within the group of five. And if the AAC is able to brand themselves as still being the top-level conference, it matters not just in terms of things like playoff selection, but it does matter in terms of fan interest, right? If you feel like you are part of a borderline power league, that matters in a different kind of way than being a lower-level league. It matters in terms of attracting coaches, because if John Sumrall says it's good enough for him, well, damn sure better well be good enough for you, because John Sumrall is really good at what he does. And I think that that also leads to players and recruits viewing this as a different level. We've seen this at times with teams moving up. I think that even a great example is with UTSA. Obviously, I'm going to talk about my Texas team just a little bit more. But, UTSA moving from Conference USA to the AAC, they're having access to recruits in the state of Texas that they never had before. They're not necessarily competing with Texas or Texas A&M for recruits, but where I think, actually, to make a comparison, and this is a little bit of a different conversation, but I had a conversation with Casey Keeler back when Sam Houston was an FCS team, and he said that what he's learned most about being a great FCS coach is that you can't just win recruiting battles against the top of your level. You have to start winning them against the bottom of the next level, right? Like you don't just want to attract kids and make them not go to Lamar, right? Like you want to attract kids who might have considered Texas State and then keep them and say, you can win more at this level. And so let's take some more shots at Minnesota, right? Like Minnesota, if you are a good kid in Minnesota, like, there are programs like North Dakota and South Dakota State that are like, why would you waste your time over there? Come win something and go to those programs, even though they might have been able to play FBS football. Well, I think that's where the AAC has been and where I think that they need to be heading forward is, look, it is very cool that you can potentially go and, be the 73rd man at, insert power program, right? Like at Texas Tech, right? Just to name another Texas program, because that's all I do. But like, would you rather be the 73rd man, like just kind of a player in a class at you know, at Iowa? Or would you rather have the chance to be a multi-year starter here? You can still transition up, by the way. You can still transfer. But, like, I think that that's the pitch that AAC teams need to continue to make. And I think that they've done it successfully over the past couple of years. And whether they're able to maintain that pitch, which partially falls on the shoulders of Tim Pernetti, will play a major role of whether they're able to continue it long term.
You know, you made me think of another kind of moment of Minnesota sports recruiting. And that was when the best quarterback prospect in the state of Minnesota went to North Dakota State, Trey Lance, and went third in the NFL draft. I watched his first game in the Twin Stadium. Like, they hosted a Pioneer Football League game, and I was there for that game. And it was like, oh, they're starting a true freshman, but he's supposed to be really good. It was like their best quarterback that ever recruited. And yeah, he looked great. And he just looked like the Gophers apparently wanted to make him a defensive back or something. And he's like, I kind of want to play quarterback. And even though he was already, and he was the best QB in the state, nope, he went on and became a Bison. And the rest was history, as they say. My goodness. Well, I think we're done stabbing Minnesota in the heart this particular show. Akron got off easy this time.
There's time. There's still time.
Yeah, but I think we'll go ahead and wrap this one up. I just wanted to take a second to thank all of you for listening. Thank our producer, Joey Aliberti. Be sure if you get a chance, like, rate, and subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on X and TikTok at CFB Survivor Show. He's Sean J. Raja. You can find his work at CBS Sports. I'm Bob Akairi. Thanks for listening, everybody.
The College Football Survivor Show, where playoff survival is always on the line.